So continuing from last week's conversation, we started talking at the opening of the year about the foundational conditions for well-being, conditions for health and ease. And we started talking about sleep, which I just think of as the first, you know, requisite condition for well-being. The Buddha has a list, of course, of the requisites, the basic things that you need for well-being. The Buddha's list is the four requisites is food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. So these are the four things that early Buddhist monastics, that renunciate monastics, need to receive from the lay people. So they need to receive cloth for robes, food every day. They can't keep food overnight, so they have to receive fresh food every day, or they have to be given food every day. And you know, not storing food overnight prevents them from really participating in lots of kinds of marketplaces, really, around food. They really have to maintain a direct relationship with the people around them. So food, clothing, shelter, somewhere to live, which, you know, for monastics, you can choose to just live at the root of a tree or, you know, out in the open. But some kind of shelter from the weather, you know, even if that's just, you know, an umbrella with a mosquito net is necessary. And then medicine, you know, as needed. So, you know, for many folks in the postmodern world, you know, these requisites are still hard to come by, right? There's still a food crisis in many parts of the world. There's still a housing crisis in many parts of the world, often many parts very close to us. There's not so much a clothing crisis for most folks. The world has produced such a glut of sportwear that, you know, people are wearing t-shirts and shorts everywhere on the globe, and there doesn't seem to be a shortage. But it's needed, you know, in some form. And medicine, of course, is a requisite that many, many folks don't have access to in a way that would be healthy. So these four requisites are still absolutely vital, and they are really the foundation. In a way, if you know, you know, Maslow's pyramid of needs, a very, very traditional model that puts, you know, basic physical survival needs at a foundation level and then gets more subtle from there as you go up the levels of the pyramid toward, you know, deeper needs like love and connection and beauty and inspiration and such. And, you know, and you could certainly argue that love and connection and beauty are foundational. You don't have to put the physical at the bottom, but the Buddha, you know, starts with these as like, this is the basis. And in thinking about us as postmoderns, you know, I think about, like, in many ways for many folks, except for the, you know, really the destitute poor, the basis of these requisites is somewhat taken care of. And again, I think, you know, medicine, meaning healthcare, is probably the worst of them for many of us, even in the developed world. But, you know, if you have enough to eat every day and enough to wear and, you know, a roof over your head, and some, you know, some amount of healthcare, then, you know, you have these requisites as a foundation. And so going further than that, you know, what in a way is the next level up for well-being, and particularly in the lives that many of us lead, what are the conditions that are really necessary for well-being? And as we talked about last week, not just for health and well-being in our ordinary life, but for practice, right? If Dharma practice is really central to you, if you have a goal, a desire to deepen in practice, you know, how do we set up the conditions for practice to be strong, to be well? So that in our practice, we're not constantly fighting against, you know, the anxious thoughts and the scattered mind and you know, unstable energy. We're not constantly fighting against, you know, anxiety and depression and sleepiness and restlessness in various ways, you know, uncontained emotionality and, you know, drama around us, social drama. How do we live and practice in a way that we are more sheltered from these, you know, dramas, these worldly winds? And so some of the foundations for these are kind of the next level of the requisites. How do we really care for the body and mind in a way that makes it more likely that we'll be, you know, able to feel at ease day to day? And so then I think of a few additional requisites then, stacking on top of the Buddha's original four. And the first of these is sleep. And then I'll add to these exercise and social contact. And, you know, when I've been on long retreat in intensive practice, or for the season that I was a monastic, sleep and exercise and social contact, in a certain way, they were woven into the day. Not so much exercise was needed because we were moving very slowly, but sleep certainly, you know, was really woven deeply into the, you know, the flow of the day. And when in renunciate practice, often the mind gets concentrated even a bit and less sleep is needed. There's less to worry about, right? The requisites are taken care of. And so, you know, these further layers of like what needs to be tended for us to feel well often are much less of an issue if your life is very, very simple or very ordered in the way that retreat life or monastic life can be. But for many of us, our life is not that simple, not that ordered, and we are subject to fierce pressure from the media world, from the social world around us. And so, how do we take back some agency, some discipline around the conditions for our own energy being well? So we talked last week a bit about sleep as the foundational kind of one of these. You know, if you're not well slept, if you're in a sleep deficit or in poor sleep in various ways, it affects, you know, every aspect of the nervous system. It affects whether we can focus. It affects, you know, inflammation in the body, basic health in so many ways. But the discipline of sleep, or I'll say like the practice of sleep, we can often be not disciplined about sleep, and in a way think about it as, you know, just like a necessary consequence of our life. You know, people can shrug off, oh yeah, I always stay up too late, or, you know, or we normalize, you know, watching screen entertainment late into the night, you know, or working late, or in various ways we can normalize disrupted sleep. And of course there's lots of good reasons to, you know, there's lots of natural life phase reasons to have disrupted sleep, right? Parents of infants have disrupted sleep for a very good reason. Hopefully it's temporary. I remember sleep training. That was really hard and, you know, temporary. We're doing it right now with the puppy. I'm the one who gets up with her at, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning to do her midnight pee. So that's been a little rough. But again, you know, temporary. It'll be temporary, God willing. And, you know, and of course, some folks, you know, have to work the night shift or actually, you know, there have demands on them for caregiving or work or, you know, any number of things that causes disrupted sleep. And that's just really challenging. And it's to be, you know, held with compassion if that's you or someone you know. But if you have the conditions in your life to, you know, to get a good night's sleep, figuring out how to do so, you know, consistently can be one of the best things you can do for your mental well-being, for your emotional health, for your ability to concentrate, and for the quality of your meditations and your practice and your mindfulness in a day-to-day way. And so, you know, you all basically know the encouragement, right, for sleep hygiene, right, to not be on screens for at least a couple hours before you go to sleep, if at all possible, you know, to minimize blue light after sunset, if you can. So if you have to be on your screen, you can get one of those things. There's an app called Flux. Apple now does it automatically. If you turn that on, where it shifts the color tone of your screen toward the amber spectrum and away from the blue light, and that can be helpful for some folks. So lots of those kinds of things exist. But mostly what I want to encourage is, yes, use any of those tools as needed. And, you know, I do have a bias toward larks over owls. So if you can go to sleep a bit earlier and wake up a bit earlier, it tends to align you with the circadian rhythm of sunset and sunrise a bit more easily. But, you know, if you're an owl and you go to sleep at midnight, just make sure you can sleep till 8 or 9, depending on your body. And so that at least you're not going to sleep late and waking up early. So, you know, trim the candle at one end, but not both. Right, so just to make sure that you have a full night's sleep as much as possible. And what you'll notice as you do this is that it can take a bit of work to reset your rhythm, but once you do, the first thing I'll encourage you to bring into your mindfulness, and this really is part of mindfulness of energy, mindfulness of the third and fourth hindrances of sloth and torpor and restlessness and worry, is to become aware of how clear energy feels and how unclear energy feels. So what are the sensations of being well slept? Sometimes we can think of feeling well as kind of the norm. And so when we feel well, we don't notice. We only notice when we feel dramatically unwell. Thich Nhat Hanh would say, you know, everyone notices when you have a toothache. No one notices when you don't have a toothache. Be mindful of not having a toothache, and then you can celebrate that. You can delight in that. You know, how wonderful to not have a toothache today. So in the same way, when you feel well rested, actually notice that. And particularly if you haven't been well rested much, it's easier to notice because it's a contrast. But notice the sensations, you know. What's the buzziness in the body like? What's your mood or emotional tone like? See if you can really get into some detail about what's it like when you feel well rested, when you're neither sleepy nor restless. And what you'll notice is that being well rested has a quality that's both, you know, balanced in energy. It's neither dull nor, you know, antsy. But it's not just sort of a neutral middle. It's like a neutral middle with an extra brightness. And that extra brightness, I think, is mindfulness, awareness, kind of inner clarity, being really present, being really available. And, you know, it's almost more palpable if you've lost it. So that's nice. You know, if you feel like you haven't been so balanced, do a bit of sleep hygiene practice. And then really notice as it starts to come back in. And it can, within a day or two, you'll feel, you know, get a few good nights' sleep, and then really notice it. So you both notice when you feel well, and then notice also, especially if it's become the norm, notice the sensations of being underslept. So, you know, when you're a little tired, notice that. When you're antsy, notice that. But also really tune into the somatic, the bodily sensations of your energy not being so well or at ease, right? For me, when I'm underslept, there can be a kind of like contracted buzziness through the body that's like almost itchy. You know, there can be just a sense of like, you know, the muscles not being at ease. They either don't really want to fire, like the muscles feel dull, or they feel like, you know, like tensed up. So really begin to track. Here's how it feels along the spectrum of my energy. And then we can begin to make sleep really part of our practice discipline. And so part of this, just like you would with meditation, can be, you know, tracking it. So if you're really not sure how much sleep you're getting, you know, begin to, you could take a little sleep journal. You could note the time when you get off your screen, and then note the time that you get into bed. And if you have a sense of, you know, when you're like, maybe you note when you get into bed and if you read or whatever you do, and then note when you turn the light out, if you want to be super precise. And then just see, you know. And then when you wake up, note the time that you wake up and notice how you feel, right? So you get a sense of how long you slept, when you went to sleep, what you did in the evening. And you'll really notice the relationship. It's a very much a direct conditioned relationship between what you did in the evening and how you wake up in the morning. And just see if you can make that connection. How does that work? And, you know, part of sleep discipline is, you know, tending your activities in the hour or two before you go to sleep, and also tending yourself in the hour or so after you wake up. So how do you wake up? Do you wake up bright? Do you wake up slow and foggy? You know, do you wake up with strong emotion? Do you wake up, you know, confused? Just begin to track it without any judgment. Just see, you know, how is that, right? And part of sleep discipline can be, what kind of practice do you do right after waking up? So for some folks, just lying there for a while, you know, gathering attention, becoming, you know, rising into consciousness slowly really works, right? For other folks, getting up right away and changing your state, taking a shower, you know, getting on the yoga mat, drinking tea, going outside. Notice what kind of tending of your state feels most helpful right at the very beginning of the day. So, you know, many of us may have the idea that meditating first thing in the morning is great. And I think it is. I've loved doing that at many times in my practice, many seasons of practice. I would be an early morning, you know, sit in meditation kind of practitioner. But I've also had other seasons where first thing in the morning isn't the right time for stillness, where it's actually more helpful for me to get up and, you know, roll out the yoga mat and do some more, you know, stretchy or even more vigorous practice. I've had times when it's right to, you know, lace on my shoes and go for a run and get outside and actually, you know, increase my heart rate, be in the colder air, move the body first thing. You know, I've had time, right now I'm in a phase where, given the rhythm with my family, the kid, the puppy, the cat, all the things, my partner, that the right thing to do actually is to get up and like feed the cat, feed the dog, pee the dog, make the coffee, you know, get breakfast settled, like do all this kind of kitchen-y animals and house kind of stuff. you know, and then, you know, once sort of everybody is set, all the animals and children and partners and whatnot, then I can turn towards something else. And then maybe I'll, you know, exercise or do something, something else. And meditation often comes later in the day for me, you know, in this current phase. So don't assume that, you know, some rhythm that someone else does or that, you know, you think is the most spiritual thing to do because it's what the monks do or whatever, or some influencer told you to do it. Don't assume that that's right for you. You know, the only way that you know what's really going to be most conducive for your own energy to be well is for you to explore, you know, for yourself with discernment and see, you know, what works there. So we are taking on then sleep as a discipline, sleep as a practice. Be mindful of your activities before you go to sleep. Be mindful of your activities after you wake up. So then to the mysterious long meditation that is sleep itself. So you can enter and exit sleep in a few ways. Certainly, as you head towards sleep, it can be a beautiful time to bring in some meditative disciplines. Some folks really love doing metta practice, loving kindness practice, as the landing sequence into sleep while you're lying there before you've fallen asleep. I'm a little agnostic about doing, you know, like serious formal kinds of practice, like mantra or watching the breath, particularly watching the breath as a thing to help me fall asleep, because I don't actually want to habituate myself to falling asleep while I'm meditating. I much more want to keep meditation, protected as a space for being awake, actually. And so, but loving kindness can be good, you know, to head towards sleep, just to wash, you know, to wash oneself with, you know, feelings and wishes of kindness and benevolence. A couple practices that are very traditional for heading towards sleep are versions of forgiveness practice. So to think through, to remember back into, you know, what I did today, to do a bit of day review, to allow to come to mind, you know, anything that feels like I've, you know, spoken unclearly, or, you know, I had an interaction that jangles a little bit, that didn't really land, and to, you know, maybe you put your hand on your heart or on your belly and just hold the self in the process of, you know, okay, you know, here's how it went today. I did my best. Here's some things that maybe I could do better, or that I could learn from, and you know, I'm going to plant the seed, the intention, to you know, re-engage my practice tomorrow and continue to work on it. This is really a version of a very traditional monastic practice. The Buddhist monks, in the tradition that I was in Burma, but this is true across the Theravadan world. There's a short Pali formula where you every monk every day has to find a monk that is senior to them in the hierarchy to do this with, and so like an older, you know, sibling, brother or sister, to support you in this practice of admitting your mistakes and letting them go. You recite this short phrase that says essentially, and it's a kind of blanket absolution. It says, probably in the last 24 hours of my practice, I've broken some rules, you know, some of the monastic guidelines, like I probably messed up a little bit or did some mistakes. And so, you know, whatever they were, I admit them, and I intend to do better tomorrow. And it's not like Catholic confession. You're not trying to like name them and be punished for them. It's really a way of renewing your intention to practice sincerely and with your whole heart. And so this is a beautiful thing to do at the end of the day. You can rest, you know, in the dark as you're inclining towards sleep, you're letting go of the work and the drama of the day. And this can be a very conscious, like, whatever was not finished from today, whatever I didn't get done, I'm not going to get it done now. Like, I'm setting it down. So you can really, like, how fully can you just let go of everything done and not done, said and not said, you know, successes and failures at the end of the day, whatever you've done, you set it down. And then you can include some aspect of this kind of self-forgiveness. May I learn from how the day went? May I, you know, continue my practice tomorrow with sincerity? And this practice of reviewing the day is actually a very deep part of what mindfulness is. The word mindfulness literally means memory, as many of you know. And the Buddha in many places defines mindfulness as the ability to remember things that were done and said in the past. And so it's actually a very classical mindfulness exercise to think backwards through the day. It's actually the foundational exercise that, if taken to its extreme, becomes the exercise in remembering one's past lives. But you can start with just remembering the past day, you know, and we'll move on from there. But start with today. And what you can do is remember, in a sense, like, you know, cardinal moments through your day. So you might be laying there and you might remember, okay, you know, remember getting ready for bed. And maybe you think of yourself in the bathroom or wherever you were, doing whatever you were doing, your ablutions. And then remember before that, what was I doing? Oh, I was reading, you know. Remember before that, what was I doing? Oh, I was checking my email, you know. Remembering before that, I was, you know, eating dinner. And you kind of just flash back through the felt sense. You could see in your mind's eye, like, where you were, what you were doing, and see if you can get the feeling. So it's not just like, oh, then I was eating dinner. But you can think, okay, I was eating dinner, so I was sitting at the table, I was eating the whatever food, you know, and it felt like this. See if you can get kind of the felt sense. Oh, right, I was troubled by this thing, or I was chewing on this thing, or I felt really at ease, whatever it was. So connect with the feeling. And you walk backward through the feelings and see how far in the day you can get, just marking back through your day. Say, that was the day. So all of these ways of disciplining ourselves as we come towards sleep, they will include aspects of letting go, aspects of gathering the attention, of relaxing. I'm not trying to focus deeply or really concentrate, because if I'm really concentrating, I'll actually wake myself back up. So it's very soft in the mind. And then there's the discipline, if you want to do it, of setting up the conditions for lucid dreaming. So dreaming happens mostly in the latter hours of the night, close to the morning, when we have come through deep dreamless sleep and we've surfaced slightly into REM sleep. And so it's long been a practice in the Buddhist world, in the Buddhist meditation world, and particularly in the tantras, in the Himalayan traditions, to really practice with dreaming. And one of those practices is to practice toward becoming awake, as it were, in your dreams, realizing when you're dreaming. So what's now called lucid dreaming. And the practice of lucid dreaming can be thought of in two parts. One is the pre-sleep intention. So as you're falling asleep, you can say to yourself, you know, may I know when I'm dreaming, may I be lucid in my dreams, may I be awake while I'm dreaming, something like that. May I be mindful and aware while I'm dreaming. And you could just choose one of these sentences that feels good to you and just think it to yourself several times, you know, like a little mantra, three times, 10 times, 20 times, as you're as you're heading towards sleep. So that's half of the conditions for lucid dreaming. And the other half that many people like to do, that we did one version of in the meditation tonight, is to do dream checks through the day, where at different times of the day, you just ask yourself whether you're dreaming, you know. And again, at the beginning tonight, I, you know, mentioned that very famous little passage of Chuang Tzu where he's dreamed that he was a butterfly. And now he says, you know, did Chuang Tzu dream he was a butterfly, or am I now a butterfly dreaming he's Chuang Tzu? And so you want to just ask yourself, and some of the ways that folks do dream checks, there's a lot of different ways. A lot of them have to do with, while you're awake, tuning into aspects of sensation that either you wouldn't notice if while you're dreaming, or if you notice them while you're dreaming, you get a hint that you're dreaming. You know, I just saw a cute one online where someone said, go to bed wearing only one sock, and then you ask yourself periodically while you're awake, and then eventually while you're dreaming, to feel the temperature of your feet. And if one of your feet is warm and the other one is cold, you know, you can look down at your feet and you can notice, right? And you'll know whether you're dreaming or not. Other people have all sorts of things, right? There's ideas that like light switches don't work in dreams, various kinds of things. I know at this point that I can fly. It's not really flying, but it's sort of like floating. I kind of bob like a hot air balloon with a little bit of impetus, but I wish I could go faster, but I sort of float in my dreams. But one of my dream checks is that I can push off from the ground a little bit. And if I'm in a dream, I'll actually kind of stay in the air for longer. So you can figure out, there's lots of those. You can, look online for what other people's are, or play with them. But they all come down in a way to just asking the question, am I dreaming right now? And tuning into your sensations. So really becoming somatically awake. What's happening right now? And, you know, in the Tibetan tradition, there's a very deep, body of practice around lucid dreaming that points toward the wisdom realization eventually that being awake and dreaming are not fundamentally different, that they are both mind-made experiences, which is true at a very deep level, and that this becomes a hint into, profound emptiness, essentially. So that exists as a practice, but mostly I want to just suggest these hints about lucid dreaming, partly just as a way to begin to include the long meditation that is sleep and dreaming as part of our practice, so that we're not just sort of forgetting everything about our inner discipline when we go to sleep, but that we start to take seriously this, third of our lives. I mean, and that's if you're getting enough sleep, seriously as a part of the flow of awareness of the mind, of experience, and that, both getting enough deep sleep that our energy is well when we're awake, but also just treating that period as a period where we can learn more about the nature of awareness, about ourselves, So another part of dream practice, of course, is to recall your dreams. So in the morning when you get up, and for a lot of people, this works best if you do it right away before you really get up and start stirring around, but to write down your dreams or make some notes about them, think through the sequence of them. And of course, there's all sorts of beautiful, psychological and mythic and process work that you can do engaging with the content of your dreams. The main one that I'll mention here in a Buddhist sense is not so much about the imagery or the narratives that happen in dreams, which which can be very revealing. But is just the piece about the dreams being a place where you'll really see whether the fundamental orientations of your practice, which is really like view and intention, so how you think about the world, how you relate to your strong emotions, and how you keep the precepts, all of those things will be apparent in your dreams, right? So you'll notice in your dreams how you erupt in anger, or when you run away in fear, or if you're in a situation where you're tempted to break a precept, and whether you do it, you know, in the dream, because you're less filtered. Your wakeful disciplines are subdued, and so you can notice then when you're dreaming. One of the ways, another way that I've used in a way as a dream check, it's not quite a dream check because it's fairly automatic. So I'll often notice this after I wake up. But I'll notice that I was in a dream and I was in some complex social situation, and there was perhaps an impulse to do something that would be the breaking of a precept. Occasionally it's violence. Often it's you know, sexual or speech. Like I'm tempted to lie in some way. And I've caught myself in the dream realizing that, like, I kind of want to lie, and then I'm like, oh, I don't want to lie, you know, like it's against the precepts. There's been moments when I've woken up and I've been really pleased, you know, that in a way the precepts, that these foundations of practice have entered in deeply enough that my subconscious is reproducing them, you know, that so it becomes like, oh well, it's just as much a place to practice when you're dreaming as when you're awake. And so to summarize, right, focusing on sleep hygiene, tracking your sleep, so tracking your evening, tracking your morning, disciplines for descending into sleep, disciplines for waking up, which are mostly about, you know, setting up the conditions for your state to be as well as possible. So do I need to change my state quickly, or do I go gently into wakefulness? And then, you know, and then how we practice fundamentally with just a sense of a very gentle but consistent, as best we can, mindfulness through the period of sleep. Right? And as this deepens, you can actually become quite lucid in and around the sleep window. When I was on retreat, on long retreat, when mindfulness is getting quite strong, at one point I got the instruction to see if I could, to try to be mindful of whether I fell asleep on an in-breath or an out-breath, and whether I woke up on an in-breath or an out-breath. And this is not easy to do. You know, very often as we're arcing towards sleep, the last thing that happens is the mind wanders. And what's really happening is you go into a little tiny dream as you're heading into sleep, right? So the dream self sort of separates from the bodily self in some way. The dream mind breaks off. But you can notice that, right? And you can notice it because you're already practicing in meditation over and over, noticing the mind wandering, and it's the same thing. So you can start to notice the first moments of sleep as a kind of, you know, mind wandering away or becoming dreamy, and you can track that, right? And you can wake up out of it and you can go back into it, or you can just notice in hindsight, start to get used to, oh yeah, this is how it starts. This is the beginning of the falling asleep. And so you just play with that, and then as we take seriously our sleep, and you know, as part of practice, we begin to just set up the conditions for deeper sleep, longer sleep, sleep that's conducive to mindfulness and clarity, and good dreams, or insightful dreams at least. more and more clear energy through the day. So pausing there. So, thanks for listening. Good, good. Sleep well, right? Hi, blessings in your practice. Thanks for watching. If these resources are supportive for your meditation and your practice, liking and subscribing helps the channel. And there are links in the description below to donate to support the Sangha and my own teaching. And you're welcome to come and join the Tuesday night gathering, which is on donation and open to all. And you can find information for that on the website. So blessings in your practice. Take care.